copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
This morning we're going to finish our first session in counseling topic. There were some points that were still missing. And then we will do with the second topic I was supposed to develop, which is the art of listening and asking questions in counseling. If you have your outlines with you, on Sunday we were at point three, what is happening to me. We considered, what can I do for you? The starting words in the session, what can I do for you? In which ways can I help you? Then we noticed the importance in point two of understanding, I feel understood, warmth, the importance of establishing a good rapport as the main goal of the first session, an atmosphere of warmth, empathy, trust. So then we considered the primary reason for counseling in the session, defining the basic needs and problems. So here we are. I think it's important in the first session to describe at least an outline of the expectations the counselee has. So I usually ask a question more or less like this. What would you like to accomplish? Where would you like to go? In which ways would you like to be helped as a result of this counseling? And usually, if possible, if there is time, I make them write them down, identify, be very objective, not only subjective. Write down your expectations, what you would like to accomplish. And I like to call these the therapeutic goals, the target goals. Sometimes it's not possible to do it in the first session for any reason, but if possible, I think it's good from the very beginning the counselee knows where we are going, our final destination. We need to be specific. We need to define specific goals because that will be our reference point to see whether we are making progress or not. So from time to time, we look back, in future sessions, we look back to our initial therapeutic goals, to our targets, and compare. Are we making any progress? How are you? How do you feel? You feel we are making, we're moving forward? So having some therapeutic goals described and written down, I think, is very, very helpful. Now, very often the counselee asks, could you tell me what is happening to me? What's my problem? They want a label. They want a name and a surname, especially for us, from medical and professional counselors, they want medical or psychological labels. For you, this is not a problem, because as pastors, I don't think they expect from you a label of sinners. You are sinners, or any label connected to their own spiritual life. Try to avoid labels as much as possible. Most of the times, labels are unnecessary. And sometimes they are very dangerous. They are unnecessary because we don't need them to work to make progress. Especially in the area of our emotions and mental health and psychiatric disturbances, one important point to remember is that labels are not something static, rigid, forever, but they may keep changing. Labels may be dynamic. So in the beginning, you think that the person has a depression, let's say a severe depression, and then as time goes by, you realize that that person turns into another diagnosis. This is possible. This can happen. So don't put labels. I said that sometimes labels are dangerous. I will always remember a case which was very sad. The daughter of a good friend of mine, actually a medical doctor, suffered from a borderline personality disorder. She was a teenager, she was 18, and she went to the psychiatrist. They had, I think it was the second or the third session with the psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist told her, I don't know if it was his own initiative or it was as a response to her question, that she suffered from a borderline personality disorder. Then the girl went back home, started looking at internet what the personality disorder was like, and she went and she committed suicide. This is a very impressive case, especially because the father was someone very near me, a colleague, a friend. Be very careful to use psychiatric and psychological diagnoses are dangerous weapons. They are dangerous weapons. Use them as little as possible. My own policy, my own habit, is to use them only when it is strictly necessary. For example, when you are requested a report from an official report for any reason, for any purpose. But in your relationship with the counselee, try to avoid the use of this weapon. As I said, most of the times this is unnecessary, and sometimes it is dangerous. So avoid labels. What's happening to me? We will see as time goes by. What I see today is that you come to me with many problems. You have many problems. You have many areas or some areas in your life that need to be worked at. So we will work together to help you, to encourage you, to find ways out. All I can say is that you are troubled by problems. This is a sort of a question I usually give. Don't get to rush. Don't be in a hurry to get conclusions too early. Too early. Although this is a basic principle in psychotherapy, it can equally perfectly be applied to pastoral counseling. Early interpretations usually are mistaken. You need your time. You need your time to think, to get to know the person, to know, as we heard from Richard and from Ed also yesterday, the life story, the background. We need to know many things about that person before getting to conclusion. So don't rush. We need to convey to the counselee the idea that we are not in a hurry. We don't work with emergencies. This is another principle I usually convey to the counselees. I have an urgent need. I have an urgent need. My answer usually, or most of the times, is I don't accept emergencies. I don't work with emergencies. If you have an emergency, you will need another sort of help. You need to go to an emergency unit. But emergencies are usually the way, unconscious way, the person uses to manipulate. Emergencies are an excellent way to manipulate the counselor, the therapist. So be very careful when they pressurize you with emergencies, a phone call, etc. You have to be very aware of what an emergency is and what it is not. And with the likely exception of suicidal ideas, and perhaps one or two more, except suicidal ideas in a depressed person, there are no emergencies in counseling. There may be emergencies in medicine, but in counseling, probably the only emergency is suicidal ideas. If someone asks for help because they have suicidal ideas, then you have to pay attention to this demand of help. Even if it sounds self-pity, manipulative, we have to pay attention to the suicidal ideas. We'll go back to that tomorrow when we consider the case study on depression. I think about suicidal ideas, that's enough. Now, tomorrow, we'll go back more to this. So don't rush to get conclusions. Take your time. There does not exist such thing as hurry. It was Jung, in a minute I give you. Jung, the Swiss psychiatrist, said, "Hurry is not of the devil, it is the devil." This was what Jung said. Hurry is the devil. And this can be applied to counseling. Take your time. We need to work in a progressive way. Here in your notes, you will find this idea that in the same way that God chose deliberately to reveal himself in a progressive way, progressively we need to understand and make progress, I play here with the words, make progress in our counseling process. In the process, progress is progressive. In the process of counseling, progress is progressive. This is the way God revealed himself, progressive revelation through the Bible, and our knowledge of the counselee must also be progressive, little by little. No emergencies, take your time. Don't rush to get conclusions. It's important to be patient. And the counselee also learns not only from our words, but from our attitudes. We are constantly sending messages, non-verbal messages. I remember several patients have told me, when I come to your office, when I am in therapy with you, it's not only what you say that I find encouraging, but the way you say it. Mm-hmm. The way you say it. The tone of voice. The quietness. I wouldn't be able to do that if I were rushed, in a hurry, nervous, tense. We need quietness. In point four, where do we want to go? Notice that There are several questions. What can I do for you? Number one, the answer is, I feel that you understand me, the purpose. Then what is happening to me? The third question. Now, where do we want to go? Question four, explaining the therapeutic process. I think it's important in the first session to give a hint of what we are going to do, both in practical terms, length of sessions, how often you will meet, etc. Even if you are not professionals, I think this is important. Richard used a very key word on the first day. He said you have to do pastoral counseling with consistency. Remember that word, consistency. Although it is true that there is some casual, informal counseling that we all do while we are taking dinner together, etc., in spontaneous conversations, pastoral counseling should have a minimum structure. It should not be casual. They should have consistency. So you should agree when you meet, for how long you will meet, etc. And of course, the contents, as we said, the therapeutic goals. Where do we want to go? I like to tell the counselee, I like to use an illustration to compare what we are going to do with different illustrations. The illustration I like to do, to use, is the illustration of climbing up a mountain. We are in the valley. We are down in the valley. We are here. And we want to reach the peak of the mountain. Hiking or climbing up a mountain is something people usually like. Now, if you want to climb a high mountain, the more complicated the mountain is, for example, if you want to climb the Everest, you need, I don't know if this is the English word, a Sherpa. You need a Sherpa. Now, what is the function of the Sherpa? Who does the actual climbing? You do the climbing. What is the function of the Sherpa?
Guidance.
Guide? Guiding? And also one important thing, helps you with the luggage. The Sherpa helps you carry the luggage. You are the Sherpa. You are the Sherpa, the counselor. In pastoral counseling, you are the Sherpa, but they are the ones who are climbing the mountain. We will not take them on our arms and climb up the Everest like this. They do need to walk. Some counselees, some people want to be taken like little children. They want us to take them on our arms and go upwards. No. We must refuse this. They will do the walking. We will guide them and we will carry the luggage, share the burden. But the actual reaching the peak of the mountain, they will do it. Perhaps you can think of another illustration. I use this illustration of the mountain and the Sherpa. Can you think of another illustration you could use? Perhaps having to do with the sea and boats and sailing and all this kind of thing, or another one. Any other illustrations that you find helpful? Yelena or Ed or any of you who is more experienced in this? Any illustrations that help the counseling process?
I mentioned, I think 2 days ago, that I sometimes the tunnel. Like when they get in a tunnel and they're deep enough, they're confused. Where can they go up? Where is the exit? And actually, I walked with them.
Good.
And yeah.
Yeah, that's a nice illustration.
And I have another one. I used to be a scuba diver. So when you go down, when you go up, you get confused, actually, where is up and where is down when you're in the water. So I said you follow the bubbles, and to go up, you have to wait in certain areas, you know, because of, you know, the, how do you call that?
Decompression.
Decompression. So then we sometimes reach the plateau, and depends how deep it was, it's going to take us a while. And it's kind of following the bubbles to know where it is. Yeah, and sometimes we just have to stop and kind of go and, you know, kind of go back to the goals and just take time to go up.
Good. Okay. Any other illustration that you find helpful? Having this illustration in mind usually helps as time goes by to see the progress in the therapeutic goals that you originally intended for the whole process. Now, let's briefly consider this point. Anticipating wrong expectations. What the counselee can expect from the counselor and what he or she should not expect. What can be expected, we have already said. Climbing up a mountain, trying to clarify, defining the goals and making progress in all these goals. The reason why I included this paragraph is because many counselee come to the counselor as a sort of magician, a magician who knows all the answers to all the questions for my life. Now, this is a childish expectation, immature expectation. A counselor is not someone who gives all the answers. Actually, a good counselor should not give answers. At least, this is not our primary function. But the counselor should make the counselee think, reflect. As we will see in a minute, see the same problem from different perspectives. I would like you to keep this idea in mind, which is very simple, but we very often fail here. Remember this: the best counselor, a good counselor, is not the one who has the best answers, but the one who asks the best questions. The best counselor is not the one who gives the best answers, but the one who asks the best questions. And we'll see in a minute why I say this. So the expectation that you will come and tell me what I should do, this is a totally wrong expectation. And you should anticipate that we will not be working this way, because this is not counseling. This would be a sort of child-adult relationship that would make dependency very, very dangerous. So, finally, the baggage needed for the journey. I have included here four features that we should probably try to verbalize, if possible, in the first session, because I think it's important that in the same way we know what we expect, the counselee knows what to expect from us, he should know what to expect from him. First of all, honesty. Honesty. Be ready to tell yourself the truth. Be ready to tell yourself the truth. Unless you are ready to open your eyes, to see your blind spots, to discover painful areas in your life, you will make no progress. We all have blind spots. We all deceive ourselves, and we must be ready to tell ourselves the truth. So, honesty. Second, courage. Be ready to change things. Be ready to change things. In the same way that we must be ready to tell ourselves the truth, we must be ready to change those areas in our life that need to be changed. Changes in behavior, changes in attitudes, changes in relationships, etc. Thirdly, as we said, motivation. The motivation. Be ready to work. Usually, from one session to another, I give the counselee homework. Some work to do at home. Reading certain Bible passages, as we heard yesterday from Ed, and this is especially true for you in pastoral counseling, or especially asking certain questions to make them think. We'll go to that in a minute. This is the sort of homework I usually do. Asking questions, I usually give them. Asking questions, reading passages, or perhaps reading chapters in a book, etc. So be ready to work. Now, I think this is all I wanted to say about the first session in counseling. Now, for the next 10 minutes till 11, I would like you to divide in small groups of four or five and share from all these things we have been talking in this first interview, which ones do you find most difficult to put into practice? Where are your obstacles, your hindrances? I think it's important that you share your burdens concerning this first session. This last part of our session, we have about 20 minutes till 11:30. We will talk a little bit about listening, the art of listening. And then in the first part of the following session, we will do the asking questions topic. Richard Winter actually said quite a lot on listening in his session. Notice in the notes, I started with a nice sentence by Shakespeare. Listening with your eyes is a delicate expression of love. This is what a man like Shakespeare said. There are two ways, actually, to listen. You may listen with your ears. Actually, you hear with your ears, but we listen with our eyes. And listening is a basic tool in counseling. As I say in the introduction, the main requisite to be a good counselor, I mean humanly speaking, the main requisite to be a good counselor is to be a good listener. To listen carefully and empathically is in itself, per se, therapeutic. Why is listening so important? I think there are basically two reasons. The first one has to do with us as human beings. Listening makes us deeply human. It makes us human. Notice animals can hear. Animals can hear. Human beings, men and women, is the only animal that can listen. Listening is a faculty which is absolutely unique in human beings. Certainly, some animals have sophisticated or developed capacities to hear, dolphins, for example, certain birds, have a sophisticated, very developed capacity to hear. They send messages. But human beings are the only ones who are able to listen. Why? Because listening, unlike hearing, listening requires reflection. Reflection, to reflect. As you talk to me, I reflect on your words. I receive your words, I receive your message, and I reflect on them. Now, reflective consciousness is absolutely unique in human beings. The capacity to reflect, what we call reflective consciousness, is unique in human beings. This is something I learned when I was preparing my, studying my specialty, and I heard this argument, this reasoning from an atheist professor. This is why it has so much value to share it coming from a non-Christian person. Animals are aware. An animal is aware. Full stop. That's the end of the story. Human beings, you and me, we are aware that we are aware. I am aware that I am aware. This double turning of your consciousness, and this is how it is called, the double turning of your consciousness is what we call reflective consciousness. It's a double turning. I am aware that I am aware, and no animal has reflective consciousness except human beings. If this sounds too academic or complicated, a simple illustration is certainly clarifying. If you have a cat or a dog, a pet, and you place it in front of a mirror, you have a mirror and a cat or a dog, what will happen? What does the mirror or the cat do? Scratching or barking? Nothing. Why? Because the cat or the dog is unaware to recognize itself in the mirror. There is no reflective consciousness. The cat or the dog is not aware that this is it. The same with a baby. Now, place a teenager in front of a mirror. The reflective consciousness, or perhaps we should say the aesthetic consciousness, is hyper-developed. Reflective consciousness, the capacity to reflect, is unique to human beings. This is an apologetic hint that helps, that has to do a lot with the ability to listen. This is why I said that listening makes us deeply human. Animals can hear, only we can listen. Sorry to draw a somehow perhaps too aggressive conclusion. When we are not listening, we behave a little bit like animals. Sorry to sound rude. If we do not listen, we are behaving like animals. We are not using our reflective consciousness. So what makes us really human, deeply human, is the ability to listen. How important listening is. Yes.
So that's why a woman feels that they leave with the dog when they're having their husband.
Could be. Yes. I will always remember when I, in my first year, when I was already a psychiatrist, a qualified psychiatrist, and I started practicing, a lady came to my office. Usually the appointments I have are 45, 50 minutes. And she started talking and talking and talking, and she spoke 45 minutes without interruption. This is not unusual. Not for women, for human beings. As we approached the end of the session, I said, okay, we'll have to stop here and continue next time. I write down where we stop and we'll continue. And she, to my astonishment, she said, thank you, doctor. It has been a very enriching dialogue. I have never forgotten that a dialogue occurs when someone is speaking and you are listening. This is a real dialogue. A real dialogue does not require two people speaking. Actually, sometimes when two people are speaking, this is not a dialogue. In Spanish, we say it's a dialogue of deaf people. They do not understand each other. Okay? When someone speaks and you listen attentively, you use your reflection. It takes an effort, as Richard said, to listen this way. Actually, as you are listening to me now, you are listening to me with a dialogue. There is a dialogue, and any speaker, any skilled speaker, knows when he or she has lost the audience. Why? Because there is no eye connection. They have gone. They are lost. Okay? So we all know when this is happening or not. And one final anecdote. An outstanding psychiatrist in Spain, he charged very high fees per visit, outstanding psychiatrist. He told his patients, okay, you share, you tell me what is happening. And it happened twice, at least I know twice, of two different persons, probably it happened more times, that while he was hearing, he fell asleep. Literally, he fell asleep twice. An outstanding chairman of psychiatry. What was the problem of this man, apart from the fact that probably he was short of sleep and he had hypersomnia? Apart from that, the problem was that he was not listening attentively. So listening is very important because it makes us human. The second reason is that listening is the core of counseling. Nothing is more therapeutic than unhurried active listening. Why? What is the mechanism behind? Neurosciences, in the last 10, 15 years, this is something very, very new, has shown us that while you are telling something, you are telling a story, you are sharing an event, okay? If you're, I'll put it in a diagram. Let's imagine that your neuronal structure is out of order. After a certain event, there is chaos in your mind, chaotic structure. When you start talking, the mere fact, the only fact of sharing this gives order, clarity, reshapes the neuronal structure in a surprising way. So we could say that after you have shared it, a surprising new structure happens. This is why sharing, talking in itself is therapeutic. Going to a counselor and just talking is a waste of time or a waste of money, some people said. That's not true anymore, and now we can prove it. Science has proved that this is not true. Talking, sharing, telling your story, unburdening your heart is per se therapeutic because it reshapes your neuronal structure. Okay, 2 minutes. On a totally different area. Some of you have asked about books.
It was still there.
Blame It on the Brain is the one I have read and I can recommend it to you. And some have asked about my own books. There are 3 books here. The one on bereavement, Tracing the Rainbow, How to Overcome Grief and Bereavement, The Thorn in the Flesh, and Praying with the Grain. Praying with the Grain is on the connection between personality, temperament, and prayer.